The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. Happy New Year, my dear listeners. Another chance for us to consider new opportunities, wonder what ifs, and think general why nots, to move on to bigger and better things. And nowadays, this is especially the case with technology. New tools and toys abound, seemingly almost daily. Today's episode of That's a Laugh helps us appreciate new technology by reminding us how inconvenient old technology used to be. We'll focus on things that the internet has all but rendered obsolete, with various chapters from the book 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet by Pamela Paul, published in 2021. Let's get started with Chapter 3, The Know-It-All. Back before we all carried the internet around in our pocket, not knowing the answer to something, even something inconsequential, could drive a person bananas. It was always the most trivial thing, too. Trying to recall the name of the guy who first traversed the Arctic by foot. What in fact happened when Andrew Johnson was impeached? What is our state flower anyway? This sort of thing could consume hours, especially when you knew that you knew the answer. All kinds of information, memories, ideas, storylines, and factoids were elusive. Most especially the one you were trying to remember when put on the spot. If you didn't know but needed to know, you had to ask everyone you met, "Can I just ask you something first? What the hell was the name of the book with the thing about octopuses in it? What was the name of the tasteless, untraceable poison at the center of that movie plot, the one whose name had midnight in it? Maybe it was a play?" The endless, infuriating, depressing parade of things you once knew, didn't know anymore, or never knew at all. Within this vague and ignorant fog of the recent past, acquiring and retaining information was a feat. Some people got it through a first-class education, and others were born with a hardy memory, and others just had the knack for amassing scraps of data that other people didn't bother to pick up. The decade-long trivial pursuit craze was based on the impossibility of retaining these myriad bits. Who could possibly get all those answers right? Back when people didn't know the answer to everything, the few who did could be lightning rods. There was that annoying person in your senior seminar who always interjected. The boyfriend who always had a lecture at the ready. The expert colleague who just had to point out the actual facts of the matter of the surprising or the surprising backstory, fishing choice bits of knowledge out of his personal treasure trove of insight and acumen. The one who always knew better. That guy. He shall bother you no longer. Everyone these days has constant access to his special information. The inside stories get out, and surprising data points pollinate. The most beguiling urban myths have no time to take hold before they're snooped away. We can all fact-check now. Though, of course, this does nothing to prevent people from thinking they know things even when they don't, or deter people who claim to know things inside what one might gently call alternate realities. Every moment of every day, people are seeking answers and finding them. Google processes more than 40,000 search queries worldwide per second, adding up to 1.2 trillion searches a year. This makes knowing things not so special. When someone exalts, "I actually knew that," meaning I didn't have to look online, does it even matter? Only I can award myself bonus points when I get through a grueling mental process like trying to remember who sung the theme song of the movie Flashdance. That singer, Cara Delevingne, no, duh, what's wrong with me? Cara Ireland? And the final exaltation of Irene Cara, yes! Without going to the internet for assistance. Yet it's so unusual, I am tempted to relay each painstaking and pointless factoid win to another person to be commended for it. Kids used to think that parents knew everything because even if they didn't, they'd make up some plausible answer on the spot, or look it up in a book later that night and feign universal knowledge in the morning. Now kids witness their parents plunging into Google to find the names of Jupiter's moons, or the precise scientific reason why oil floats on water. They learn early on that their parents don't know everything, but the internet, oh, the internet does. Chapter 5, Losing Your Ticket. It had to happen to all of us, it seemed, at least once, though you'd swear after that first time that it would never happen again. You'd be running late to the airport, going over your mental checklist. Bags packed, suitcase labeled, traveler's checks in hand. And yes, you remembered your passport. Only then, just as your taxi approached the terminal, would you realize, horror-struck, that you'd left your plane ticket at home. Tickets, they were forgotten, lost, left behind, slipped out of your wallet and stuck to the back of something else, never to be recovered. You'd forget your tickets to tonight's show at the office. The image of the envelope tucked into the first compartment of your standing file rack, mocking you in your mind's eye. You'd have no idea what the hell you did with your monthly bus pass or the tickets to next week's game. You might have to fill out a form or spend hours on the phone with customer service, frantically trying to persuade someone that, yes, you did buy a ticket and you were you. Occasionally, you wound up missing out on whatever you had planned. It won't happen again. Your ticket, whether for the plane, the train, the show, the commute, or the World Series, is online and it's on your phone. You couldn't lose it if you tried, nor can you lose your speech or tear it up dramatically in front of a crowd because that too is on your phone. Nor can you throw your ticket in the trash and be done with an obligation you wish you'd never agreed to in the first place. It's hard to lose anything that exists as an image or block of text when it's in the link and the attachment and is always backed up. You have the automated confirmation. You have the scannable QR code. You took a screenshot of it because you were smart with your smartphone. One of life's great and ever-repeated stressors is, blessedly, gone. Unless, of course, you lose your phone. Chapter 6, The Meet Cute. How many couples do you know who actually met for the first time in an elevator? How many lonely singles have found their one and only at someone else's wedding, a wedding they almost didn't attend, their frenemy's wedding? How often would it happen that a woman tripped, albeit adorably, while running late, perhaps to meet the wrong person, and literally and metaphorically fell into destiny's arms? That kind of meet-cute was the stuff of rom-coms, and thus happened far more often in the movies than it ever did in real life. Yet, when it did take place down here on Earth, the result was so shiny and enchanted, it was a story to be savored, to be shown off in a wedding announcement, or in the class notes of an alumni magazine, RIP, and described over and over again at family dinners forevermore. Even if that first meet wasn't especially cute, the How I Met Your Mothers were still clues to the secret behind each couple and perhaps the closest you'd come to understanding the mystery of how one person you knew ended up tied to another one altogether, especially if the two seemed an odd or improbable match. It turns out that he was the friend of her former roommate's ex-boyfriend, who just happened to show up that night. They met in the produce aisle of Fairway, or in that long line at the Balboa Theater for that Cannes favorite, which turned out to be terrible, and they had so much to complain about. Great potential would lie in these chance encounters. Just hearing them, perhaps only during the wedding toast, would open up the possibility that if he met her or him this way, it could happen to you. And so, despite its statistical unlikelihood, the meet-cute remained the stuff of daydreams and the basis of those encouraging words your best friend would console you with when you bawled on the bathroom floor during your interminable single years. "You'll see," she'd say, spinning out the possibilities. "You'll be sitting on a bus when a stranger will take the seat beside you, casually unlooping his backpack and placing it on his lap, where you can just make out the title of his paperback. It's a good one. It could happen on the train. It could happen in the rain. Maybe you're both Dr. Seuss fans. You could start chatting each other up in a cafe in the days before everyone had coffee with their laptop or phone. Try to imagine what kind of weirdo in the 80s would haul a typewriter to the local Starbucks. The "I see you over there" on the subway was so rife with possibility that it spawned an entire genre of local classified ad, The Missed Connection, a joy to readers of alternative weekly magazines. R.I.P. Then it all migrated online. Craigslist, that 1.0 innovator, spawned the whole internet of dating with its early digitalization of newspaper missed connections, and personal ads, and everything else ads. Soon enough, the internet was the elevator, and the movie line in the department store, and everywhere else. It was where we formed those connections instead. And the internet got very, very good at its job. It matched an exciting number of early adopters and then mated new programs that matched people even better. It spawned JDate and OkCupid and Match and Bumble and the remorseless Tinder, out Yenta-ing the Yenta, leaving little to chance. Now we pick and choose our way to the perfect match, according to pre-selected criteria that filter out people who may not share our religious beliefs or passions for gardening, but who may have, we'll never know, made us deliriously happy. We are all following the formulas and obeying the algorithms set out by teams of unknown workers deep in Silicon Valley. In 2013, meeting online for heterosexual Americans eclipsed meeting through friends as the most popular way to find a romantic partner, a dominance that has continued apace. Today, 7 in 10 same-sex couples find each other this way. All told, 9 out of 10 couples in the New York Times wedding announcements met online. The stories of their first encounters basically free advertisements for competing dating services. The only question that remains for singles is, which platform to choose? Chapter 10, Being Late. Wait, you're 20 minutes late? I had no idea. I mean, if anything, I'm grateful. I finally had a chance to read that crazy Nicolas Cage interview that blew up the internet this morning. Or maybe it was yesterday morning, and I also saw that cat thing. You can tell I'm behind. But I did use the time to also catch up on email, or at least some of it. Hold on just one more minute. Can I finish writing this one last one? Thanks, and thank you for being late. Maybe you can go ahead and catch up on your thing too? Nobody has to feel bad about being late anymore, because waiting is free time, gained time, magic internet time. And all of us can use it. Lateness is also rarely unexpected because we text from the train about the signal failure and ping again when we are 2 minutes away and let our next meeting know we're running just 2 minutes behind. NP, the person will reply, I'm delayed too. If our meeting is virtual, we don't ever have to leave the screen to accomplish this. We are all late all the time, even though we know the time better than ever before. Our alarm clocks never run out of batteries, and no one needs a watch unless it's a smart one, and the time is all synced together in the cloud, even when it leaps forward. In this curious world of constant time awareness, others' persistent lateness not only excuses our own, it helps us keep up with a clock that is always 2 steps ahead. Next time, please be a little bit later. Chapter 13, The Phone Call. People have always spent lots of time on the phone. The difference is that before, we spent it on actual phone calls. Imagine that. The idea that the little device tucked into our pocket or clutched in our hands is called a phone at all seems odd when you consider what it really is, a computer. Does anyone in his right mind use an iPhone 12 Pro Max primarily to make calls? People would sooner use their phone to order pizza from Seamless than they would to call up the pizzeria. If the phone somehow rings, we usually pick it up only by accident. Ack! I meant to press the red. After the pandemic struck, people momentarily rediscovered that weird opportunity between texting and FaceTiming, the phone call, as if they'd never partaken in one before, certainly not intentionally or for fun, because these days, when someone asks you to chat, the baseline assumption is that the chat will be text-based. Speaking to someone by phone has evolved into touching base or checking in, either of which is a brief, intentional exchange, most often because it's too much to type in a text while wearing gloves or running. MIT's guru of internet sociology, Sherry Turkle, calls this general tendency the flight from conversation. But we used to talk on the phone a lot, and people loved it. Kids wondered when the phone rang if it could possibly be for them. Teenagers adored talking all afternoon and into the night and pined for a princess phone or even a line of their own. For adults, talking on the phone was a quick way to alleviate the tedium of housework and parenthood and just plain nothing-to-do-ness. "Get off the phone!" family members would yell at one another. "Mom, she's been on the phone for over an hour!" "Are you still on the phone?" people called each other for no reason. They also called each other for good reason. On the phone, things got done. Being good on the phone was a valued skill at work, worth boasting about in a job interview. In the workplace, the phones were constantly ringing. Entire jobs were built around the telephone. Secretaries, customer service representatives, phone salespeople, operators. Most of this turf now belongs to robots and bots. The laziest of employees knew that one of the most efficient ways to look busy was to wear a headset and bark into it at regular intervals. A power move was to have more than one line to yourself. Even if your job had nothing to do with telecommunications, you were likely on the phone, or trying to avoid being on it, most of the day. Thank goodness that's over. Why the post-phone generation, might wonder? Well, for one thing, the phone always rang at the wrong time. Phone calls could be presumptuous and intrusive, forcing you to engage without preparation. Phone calls were rude. "What makes you think I can drop everything and talk to you right this instant?" you wanted to cry out when you were in the basement, emptying the mop bucket while the phone trilled belligerently upstairs. Nowadays, people know you are far too busy on the phone with other things, Nobody dares interrupt your game. Just as you arrive on level 7 for the first time, with an unpremeditated call. No one rings when you're in the painstaking process of tapping out an important text or issuing instructions to Siri, unless it's a robot call or an emergency. They know to ping first, reaching out in a far less obtrusive manner. Let's get one thing clear. Do not call unannounced unless someone's dying, explains modern etiquette guide Victoria Turk. The proper thing to do is text someone first or send a polite email in advance asking if it's okay to call, even if that call is merely to clarify an inscrutable text in recent group chat. Frankly, texting is often better. You can read the message when you want to and answer when you choose. People for whom English isn't a first language can go at their own pace and can look up words online. Texting gets it all down in writing. The rare in-depth phone call that somehow still occurs generally is taken by the person sitting directly behind you in an enclosed space. "I'm on the train," he'll begin, and then, just as you attempt a nap, launch into a heated monologue about his contractor's failure to show up that morning. Or someone will answer a blaring phone in an open-plan office and subject everyone to the details of their dental coverage. It may be that people are so unused to talking on the phone or so used to wearing headsets, they've lost all sense of volume control. We talk on the phone like we don't know how. It's possible we no longer do. And Chapter 16, The School Library. Who didn't love the weekly escape to the school library, where you got to sit on a carpeted floor rather than in a stiff desk chair, to listen to a story read aloud by a librarian rather than to the teacher explaining the day's math assignment, to find yourself captivated by a book you would have never picked out yourself, whether because its cover looked too dated or because it featured a squirrel? The school librarian seemed to know exactly which one would enchant the class each week. Even kids who weren't readers welcomed the musty paper and glue smell of ancient Caldecott honorees, and a time when the rowdy kids might be quiet for just a minute, even if only through the forceful shush of the librarian. Then there were the rows and rows of picture books to wander through, worlds in which you could be left alone for a spell, and someone else would put the books away afterward. The kids who didn't have many books at home had the freedom to choose any book they wanted. Sometimes you discovered something on your own. Sometimes you consulted the librarian, and she always seemed to have the answer. For the bookish among us, it was the best part of school. But that fusty old school library has been updated, revitalized, and retooled for the 21st century. It's no longer even called a library, but is known instead as the Media Center, or the Creation Station, or the new jack-of-all-trades multipurpose room. That is, we need more space. In this new space, troublesome bookshelves, walls, and barriers that formerly blocked the paths of new communication, computers, have been cleared out, and any remaining shelves have been emptied of old ideas and left largely empty of the nettlesome impediments that are books. The school will assure you that those books were outdated and that replacements should arrive in the future, budget permitting, though you may find yourself waiting for years. Meanwhile, the Media Center is open, collaborative, and airy enough for a free exchange of ideas to swish about. Something closed books cannot offer. Students can enter and log on with ease. All of this is assuming the school library hasn't been eliminated altogether. In New York City, the number of schools with libraries fell from 1,500 in 2005 to 700 in 2014. The number of students or schools did not fall alongside it. In Britain, 22% of teachers reported in a recent survey that their library had suffered at least a 40% cut in funding since 2010, and 21% said their budget was insufficient to encourage students to read for pleasure. Mind you, kids weren't the ones clamoring to abandon the school library. They already have their technology class and their school-issued laptop or tablet, and their very own smartphone and computer at home, making the draw of the media center sketchy at best. Surveys and sales show that children, even screen-happy teenagers, prefer printed books to e-books by a wide margin. They also enjoy having access to free books. And it's not just kids. According to a 2016 Pew survey, 53% of millennials ages 18 to 35 said they'd visited a library or bookmobile in the previous year. A 2019 Gallup poll found Americans visited the library more than they went to the movies, with young adults, women, and low-income earners visiting libraries most frequently. These are people who want and like to read, and these are people who may not be able to otherwise afford those books. But good luck to the kid looking for help figuring out what to read next, seeking advice along the lines of, if you liked X, you might enjoy Y. Many schools, even in upscale and progressive districts like Montclair, New Jersey, no longer have a librarian on the premises. Fully 206 out of 218 public schools in Philadelphia have no librarian at all, and 200 have no library book collection. California has the worst ratio of students to school librarians in the nation, 7,000 to 1. The logic on the part of school administrators, having invested heavily in computers, seems to be that kids can navigate their own way. If they are doing research, they can just Google tidbits and resort to hunting for a book on the spare shelves only if it's truly necessary, and assuming it's even there, now that nearly all the reference books are gone. But, as the novelist Neil Gaiman put it, Google can bring you back 100,000 answers. A librarian can bring you back the right one. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number, one more time, is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.